You are now listening to the Project Kuwait.
To the Project Kuwait.
To the Project Kuwait.
Where we stop at nothing to bring you the right facts on health, fitness, and psychology. Featuring some of the world's most experienced professionals. So you can learn, lift, and live. With your hosts, Meg, Dr. D, and Mehdi.
In this episode of The Project, me and Dr. D get into a heated discussion in like the first hour mark. We go for 20 minutes arguing back and forth. And the poor guest, she had no idea what was going on.
Oh my God. And Mehdi throws a question that it was, I don't know what it was. It was very interesting, but I felt like he didn't understand what I was saying. So if you really want to know, this one, we really argued a lot. This will give you some understanding
drama.
Of how he triggers, how Mehdi can be dramatic, but triggers me big time. Anyways, we had a speech therapist. She was excellent. There's so much information you can learn from our guest on child development, language development, and what are some procedures or common things you should ask if your child is suffering from language disorder.
And when you guys see this posted on Instagram, please leave us a comment below with who you agree with, Mehdi or Dr. D.
And
don't forget to leave us a rating and review.
All this and more in today's episode.
Dr. D, when I point the finger, it's on you, Dr. D.
I always fail at these little tests.
I love this show.
You remind me, like whenever I record these Kuwait TV, they have to redo it because he always says 1, 2, 3, and then he points his finger and I'm like, at a stop. And then he's like, after all these months of working with you, you still don't know a finger means start. I'm like, okay, repeat. And then they clap. Now they clap because they figured I can't sustain my attention. So, well, Kira, thank you so much for being with us. I wanted to introduce you, but I'm going to let you introduce yourself. But I am so excited just because I don't work with kids, but I know you have been doing an amazing job. Of course, I've known you for, it seems like a long time. You're amazing, a power woman, super mom. I mean, you have so many things going on. And you know, I've always admired that. People always think that I'm a superhero, but after you, I'm nothing. With a new baby and
two
kids. And then what you've started just like since November, you started doing more posting on your Instagram, educating parents. Because I often get asked these questions about development, but it's not my area. Speech, pathology, they ask me things like, when do I take my kid? When do I know that they're struggling? So I thought, you know, you're the expert in my mind and you do an amazing job educating. So welcome to the Project Kuwait.
Thank you, really. Thank you for having me. Okay. Do you want us to get started?
So just introduce us to yourself, like your experience, your degree. How did you get into this field?
Well, when I was in high school, I never thought of speech and language therapy. I never knew it exists, actually. So I started a degree. I wanted to be a physician, like a doctor. The stigma of doctor or architect, you know, in our country.
Yeah.
So I was doing biology and I met, now she's a fellow speech. So I met a lady, she introduced me to, she was in her first year of speech and language therapy. She introduced this field to me. This is my calling. This is what I want to do. So I dropped biology and I studied again during summer for the entrance exam. You know, there is the exam and I was chosen and we were like 12. There was only 12 that can enroll in the speech and language therapy program. And I was one of them. And here I am. So this has started. Yeah. And when I graduated, I went to Kuwait. I worked there for 13 years. And during my work experience, I did psychology and a master's degree in speech and language therapy. All this with the support of my husband. So after the speech therapy, I met my husband. We met in Kuwait, actually. And he was very supportive in everything I do. So I did this because I believe psychology is very important just to understand parents and children and to be able to work more as a speech therapist, like with them. So, right.
Well, I know Danny. Danny's an amazing person, husband. I mean, and you know, to be honest, it's very important to have, you know, your partner be supportive of what you do, or you wouldn't be able to do the things you do and the passion that you have for, you know, speech and language pathology. And even like, you know, here you worked with kids, you were at school systems.
Yeah.
So I feel like he does play a big role, and also that you're very passionate about trying to help as many kids. I mean, and you don't only just talk about with your Instagram, which later on I'll ask you to mention it so people can also know. And when we post it, we'll say it. But I also noticed that you you know, a lot of your followers or even people that ask you questions, they ask a lot of questions about, you know, development. Seems like a lot of, especially new parents. Well, I know that when I had Larson, which by the way, Mehdi, Larson is the same age as her daughter, Gaia, and Larsa is the same age as her son.
Oh, wow.
But then Kira went on and had a third child, which then I thought, this is not going to be a competition. I'm done. Well, the idea is that it really, truly, I mean, I was reading like some of your posts and some of the people that ask you questions of, you know, just even simple, like to me, obviously, simple questions, but really people need to feel comfortable when they're talking about development of their child.
You know, children have always been my passion. Like since I was 15 years, I used to work like to get just the extra money with kids. So I've always loved kids. You don't learn everything in university. So I always read. I read a lot about child psychology, about how to raise kids, about everything I do. Like, I like reading. And this is why I never went by the book with the kids. It's a personal experience with all the readings, all the research, all the experience I have. All the discussions I do with parents. So it taught me a lot. So, and I experienced on my kids after having Gaia, who's 14 now, and Chris was 10. Look, I have a third baby. She's one now. So I have this experience with the kids. That's why I was passionate. Why not to help others? And I was pushed. I always pushed and supported by Danny. So this is where I started the Insta account to be like to reach more people, to be able to educate as much as I can, to be able to support, to help parents. And as you said, small tips sometimes like when to stop, how to stop potty training. If he's crying, what to do? He's not sleeping well. He stands up in his bed and he cries. He asks for me, should I pick him up or no? Like these small, you know, kids are manipulative. And it's just how to do, how to love them, how to give them all the support they need. Everything is through love and care.
Now, a quick question. I mean, being a speech pathologist, I want to dive into some of the questions that I have because my son had a speech issue growing up. He was, I think, 2.5 or 3 when we realized that we needed some intervention. At 2, we had my cousin, who's an ABA therapist. She intervened a little bit, and ABA is very rigid, very strict, and it's very, you know, trying to reinforce that behavior. And he took steps back after that. But what are some of the common things that parents should look out for at the age of 2 to 3? Because we kept getting the, oh, don't worry about it, don't worry about it. But we knew that there was something off, and we spoke a lot for him as parents. And I think that's why he didn't have to use, I mean, and we taught him sign language at a young age, like more, you know, like Apple and all that stuff. So that kind of had a reverse effect, but it was good because he was 8 months old and he could say, I want more. He could communicate. He was communicating at like 7.5 months, I believe. But 3 years old, he was 3 years old. And that's when we were like, all right, we really need some intervention. Here in Kuwait, we went to Fawzia Sultan. They have a great center here in Kuwait. But what are some of the things parents should look out for? Some red flags to intervene? Because not necessarily if a kid has a speech issue, that obviously means, you know, that doesn't mean they have a developmental issue. I mean, they're two separate things from what I understand. So what should parents look out for?
Well, you mentioned something very important before diving into what should parents be looking for, is that we always, even from professionals, we get the answer to our questions like, yeah, wait until he gets. I myself was late to talk. he will be talking. Don't worry. Just give him some time. We always hear this.
Yep.
I always advise parents to follow their really, they got their instinct. Like, if you feel there's something wrong, go and search. Go check with therapist. Like at the age of 2 and 3 or at any age, if there is no eye contact, kids do not initiate communication. Like they do not want to communicate. When you call them, they don't look at you. You feel like they are not hearing you. But when you do tests, we see that there's normal hearing. And sometimes there is a hearing loss. It's not discovered until this age where the kids should be starting talking and they don't. At the age of 2, like kids should understand simple instructions like give me, take. They should start talking. They should have like at least 50 words and trying to combine words like saying daddy car to mean daddy went in his car, mommy apple to say mommy, I want an apple or mommy, give me an apple. So they should start combining words at this age. They should have a lot of vocabulary that is the familiar and frequent one. The things they see and play with and eat like bottle, milk, go, car, all these words. They should be able to say them and to understand the simple instructions also. But eye contact is at any age. Like if there is a delay in social skills, like kids are very reserved, they don't like to play in the play skills, they don't like playing, they don't know how to play, they don't know how to use, they are not interested in toys, they didn't start pretend play, like taking a cup and pretending they are drinking from a cup. All these signs, it's not only talking and expressing verbally. So
Mehdi has DJ is 5 years old, right?
Mehdi? Yeah, DJ is five. Alhamdulillah, right now, I mean, he's right up there. He still has a little bit of a speech issue with the tha and saying three and some of the sha signs, but it's gotten better over the years. And he's 5 and a half now. He's reading basically on his own. I mean, we're fine with that. And we believe that his speech issue was because he had really bad eyesight. And, you know, even his eye doctor was like, yeah, well, if he can't see someone talking to you, how are you going to mimic that motion with your mouth? So, I mean, he's fine right now, but we did work hard. I mean, he went to speech therapy 2 times a week and it was rigorous. We did all the stuff at home. I mean, it was like physical therapy. When you break a bone or when you get hurt, you have to do the homework. You have to do the home exercises. Yeah. So, I mean, how important is the practice and stuff at home that the speech therapist or a therapist gives you to practice?
Yeah, it's a very main component in therapy. Like when, especially in young ages, like when we do therapy, sometimes kids do not need therapy. It's the parents who need coaching and parental coaching to support their children, because there are lots of things we can do to support our kids to learn. Because there are kids who just get delayed because of environment issues, because of parents not knowing how to give them proper feedback, how to let them initiate the communication. I really work a lot with parents just to teach them how to let them talk, because parents tend to do all the talking. They tend to ask too many questions. They tend to give them before even the kids ask. So this is where we should... I teach parents many strategies. One of them is like waiting, listening, waiting. Sometimes you just count to 10 before you talk. Let them process this question, this instruction. Give them time. Listen to their tiniest communication tentative. Even if they look at something, they are trying to communicate. When they produce a sound, they are trying to communicate. So we teach parents. In other cases, like there are things we ask them to do, we work with the kids, we do the therapy, and we ask parents to practice, because this is how brain works. And Dr. D, you can also emphasize on this, like the brain needs repetition. So the neurons get this info. When we repeat, it gets acquired, it gets stuck, it gets there. They really acquire it and they can use it. Like this is how we learn. And this is how actually vocab is learned. Like we need to repeat many times in many different contexts the same word so the child can understand it and then say it.
I think that you've made 2 really great points, which is something I see with adults. I work with young adults and older, as you know. So, but even then, like having parents being educated that there are certain things that they have to do, like in regards to listening, for example, or in regards to being able to have an intuition. Like when, you know, when people, like what Mahdi was saying earlier, is like what happened is like parents have an intuition saying that there's something wrong, or that there might be, you know, they're feeling that maybe something else is going on with their child. And then you go to these professionals who minimize it, you know, water it down, saying, oh, don't mm-hmm. worry. And I think this inhibits the child to getting treatment right away. So, exactly. and the same as even the same thing with psychotherapy, when the parents have a feeling, or the kid is coming and saying to their parents, obviously mine are older, and they're saying there's something wrong with me. And the parents feel that there's something wrong with them. But then everyone says, well, I was like you. You're just a teenager. I was also feeling depressed. Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. I think what happens is that we talk to other people. People are not professional in this field. And then they water it down, which in my situation and similar to yours, then the child doesn't get the treatment right away. So I guess my question to you is, how important is it that when a parent has an intuition that they might be something wrong with their child's development, how important is it that they seek help right away? Or is it okay to wait 2-3 years? Like for me, sometimes these people have waited 3 years before they come to me, and then I realize that they're depressed, for example.
Yeah, absolutely right. Sometimes we just, like when I get questions, my child is 2 years, 8 months, 2 years, 2 months, 2 years and a half, and he's not talking. He understands, but he's not talking. My advice to them is go just do a simple assessment with a speech and language therapist, no matter what the pediatrician tells you, no matter what your mom or your aunt or your sister, just go. It's a simple 1 hour appointment with a specialist. She will assess, she will evaluate all the areas, like the receptive language, the expressive language, the prerequisites to communication, the attention, a bit the play skills, the social skills. Like once you have this evaluation, she will guide you. Either she tells you you need just guidance to support your child. She may tell you you need to seek advice with another specialist. You need a diagnosis, you need a therapy. Like it's a simple 1 hour checkup, let's say 1 hour appointment for evaluation. That's it. Why to wait? Why? And then after a couple of years say, oh, I wish I took my child when he was younger. Like we lost 2 years of his life. This is my main advice. Why not? Don't wait. And whenever you feel something, like as you mentioned, the intuition, and you have a specialist or your pediatrician or whoever telling you it's okay, wait and you will see, and you still feel there's something wrong, go to another person. Don't just wait. Don't just take feedback or the advice of one person.
Why do you think parents are in your field? I mean, in my field, it could mean a lot, like a stigma. They want to avoid being labeled that they're depressed. For you, like parents, since the kids are small and they need the advocacy of their parents, why do you think parents are hesitant?
Reluctant, yeah. One of the things is that, you know, when we're pregnant and we imagine this perfect child and we don't want to believe that there's something wrong with my child, sometimes it takes them a long time to just believe there's something wrong, and this is where they acknowledge the problem and they start searching. You have sometimes the mother who's really fighting to do a checkup for her child, and you have the husband, the dad, who's refusing because of the stigma, like, no, nothing's wrong with my child. I was late to talk. This is what my mom used to tell me, and here I am. There's nothing wrong with me. So you have this, they refuse to admit, like to acknowledge there's a problem, and there's always reasons. Like the main reason is because we speak two languages at home. I know he's late because we speak three languages at home, because I speak to him French and his dad speaks Arabic. So this is why I know he's late and he'll be late. No, this is wrong. So yeah, you have many reasons.
Actually, I'm glad that you said that, because I saw your post on that. I always follow everything you say, even though I don't work with kids, but I tell other people, go see Kira, she knows. The thing is, you're right, because this happened to me, you know, when I was a kid. So, I mean, I wasn't delayed in my speech, but I remember, you know, a counselor, and when I immigrated to the US, a counselor saying, I wanted to learn Spanish. So I was already just, I was learning English also. So I went to her and I said, I really want to sign. You know, your counselors back then, they had to approve what you register for as a language. So I want to learn Spanish. Yeah. And she's like, no, 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 you cannot learn Spanish. You cannot take Spanish because you're just learning English. That will confuse you.
Oh.
So, you know, and so I think I'm glad that you brought this up because I think a lot of times parents are under that misunderstanding. So she refused. But anyways, I signed up. I have no idea. I was stubborn since I was 10. So obviously,
I did.
And I don't know. I mean, back then, I didn't know it was intuition. My parents didn't care either way. I mean, they didn't speak English, so it didn't matter to them. And I took one semester of Spanish, actually it helped me learn English faster. And I started tutoring students for extra money, Spanish. And here I am learning Spanish and English. So obviously, you know that this counselor didn't know much. But even now, 21 century later, many, many years, I won't say how much, my age is. But still, you get these parents that says, no, no, no. They do two things. No, they are delayed in speech because they're trilingual or bilingual. Or no, we can only concentrate on one language because if we teach them another language, they get confused. Is that really true?
Not at all. Children can learn many languages, like if they hear it enough and they practice it enough. Like if what can you do with a family where the mother only speaks French and Arabic, the father only speaks like Russian, and the common language is English. What do you do? Like, which language do you ban? No, I never tell parents to stop using languages. If a child will be delayed, he will be delayed if he's monolingual or bilingual or trilingual. It's not the number of languages they are using with him. It's because he has this predisposition to have language delay. Once he has language delay, and if it's severe to a point that really he's not able to process these three or four languages, we try to minimize to two, maybe to three. It depends really on each family. Like, it depends and on the child himself. But no, never the talking, speaking many languages never is never the cause of language delay. Never, ever. It has proven it gives cognitive advantages to people because you're using your brain in different ways. You are categorizing the languages. You are like working harder to try not like now I speak French and Arabic and I need to speak now only in English. Like I need to work harder to try to bring these, all the words I have, all the structure of the sentence is different. Like it's really a plus to people.
I've read several studies that actually say that if you have several languages under your belt, you're usually really good at math too. So I don't know how true that is. I mean, I've read a bunch of studies that have said that. Have you seen that? Is that, you know, something that's come across your table at all or no?
Good at math?
Yeah, that there's a correlation.
The connection of languages, you mean?
Yeah, there's a correlation between being multilingual or trilingual and being extremely good at mathematics.
Well, it didn't help me, but I'm terrible at math and I'm trilingual.
It might be true. Why? Because when you are learning, it's like when you are driving and you are concentrated on just driving, all your focus is on driving. You get these. If there are distractions on the way, you know that I am focused. I know I can use these multiple skills, but I want to focus. I want to use all this attention to focus on my driving. And this is what happens. Your brain is like stimulated in many different areas, in the areas of language itself, in the areas of the connection between meaning of the word and how to say the word. Like all these connect, you are using a lot of structures in the brain. This is why logic may be also stimulated in this way. I would love to read this article.
I'll pass some of them on if I can find them. But go back.
It's been proven like it delays Alzheimer's. This is for sure. It was proven. And it helps children acquire language more quickly and be able to communicate and acquire social language, like social skills, I mean.
So question back to the speech and language. I mean, seeing how that's like your wheelhouse right there. What are some of the things that parents should look for when they seek out a speech and language, a speech pathologist? I know for us, we went through like 10 till we found the right one. And we had some that just came home. They gave us worksheets and we paid them 20 KD. And I was like, what? Or 30 KD or 40 KD. I'm like, are you serious? You haven't even sat with my son for more than 10 minutes and you're just giving me a bunch of worksheets? That's not even worth the money. That's just laziness in my perspective. So what are some of the cues that a parent can look out for when they're going to visit a speech pathologist, especially in this region?
Yeah.
Given that we have a lot of charlatans that pose as being the best and they have degrees from here and there and everywhere. So what could I look out for as a parent that tells me when I walk in the door, okay, this person has A, B, C, and D. They did A, B, C, and D. I want to trust them with my child.
You're right. First of all, it depends also on the problem you are searching or seeking help for. Because as a speech therapist, we study a lot and we study to work with all ages, from babies to adults. And we don't, of course, I personally don't work with adults in strokes like and aphasia. It's not my area. So we should really check for people who are specialized in the area or the problem that my child has. And as you said, there are people who says they can do anything and everything. And this is where you don't want to go, because people who do everything, they are not good in. You cannot be good in everything in all specialization, because once we graduate, we continue a path of certifications and trainings and seminars and conferences. We have to keep updating ourselves and our information. This is why first you should just ask them. And I tell parents who do not ask me who you are, I tell them, you don't want to know who I am. I graduated this year. I have this experience. I worked with similar cases. I did this, I did that. So they need to know also, and they should be asking the specialist, what are his certificates and why he's credible in this area and what can he do and what are the outcomes he did with other kids who had similar cases. And I think parents also need to be educated on the problem of their kids and reading between the lines. And you can tell if the person is just saying nonsense, acting, or really he's a person of confidence. And they should also see the questions he's asking. Like, because when you ask these specific questions as specialist, it tells the parents, okay, he knows what he's doing. The one main thing is not hiding. When you have a professional who hides and who tell parents, you cannot come in the therapy room. When I finish, he'll go out to you. I know parents who came to me like and telling me, I don't know what they were doing with my child. He spent 2 weeks, 3 weeks going to them and crying in the session. This shouldn't happen. If the child is crying, he needs support maybe from the parents. Why not to have the parents in until he gets used to the specialist? Like, the main thing is that they don't tell parents what they are doing. Mm-hmm. They don't inform them.
Right. And I think that's a really great point, because I mean, I think in this part of the region, I also notice, like, I educate my students all the time, when you're going to a therapist, regardless if it's, or any doctor per se, or, you know, any specialized person, I find it here that they get embarrassed asking the individual, what is your credentials? Right. And I always teach my student, like, you know, you go to someone who's claiming they're a psychologist. Okay, well, what makes them a psychologist? Do they have a bachelor? Because that's not a psychologist. Do they have a master's? And that's a therapist. What is their master? Do they have a PhD? I mean, they get so embarrassed asking, and because they have them hanging on the wall behind them, they feel like they are invading. And I think it's very important for parents and individuals to be able to ask those questions. That's their right. You know, exactly. They're paying for a service. It's their right to be able to question me, Google me, come to meet me with the first session, ask me all the things that I know. What do I know? What do I not know? What is my specialty? As you said, there are people that are advertising themselves as they know everything, and it's impossible to know everything.
Yeah,
and you have areas of specialty, especially in your area. I think speech and language area, it requires certain specialties, certain experience, and certain diagnosis. Like, it can be that you are a speech therapist who can do from 0 to 50 or 100. And if that's the case, I for me, I would be questioning that. So I think it's important that parents know that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't, it's true because a lot of parents don't know that they're supposed to be in the session with their child. They think they're supposed to stay out.
Yeah.
That's a good point, Dr. D. Question on that, what you just brought up, Dr. D. Now, what are some of the different methods that speech pathologists use when, you know, treating and diagnosing? I mean, it's like me as a baseball coach, there are certain schools of thought, you know, that run true. There's like the Ty Cobb school. There's this school of thought. You know, there's like four or five of them. What are some of the predominant ones that some of the parents could ask when they walk in the door?
There's no specific approach because we work with a variety of areas. As a speech therapist, just to mention, we work with speech sound disorder, like speech disorder, which is articulation and phonological disorders, phonology. We work with language delays, like language and language disorder, which is words and how to put words to express our thoughts. Social communication, pragmatics, it's when to use, how to use, how to stand, how to look. All these that comes around the language. You have the fluency, the stuttering, fluency disorders. You have voice disorders. You have feeding and swallowing. All these areas have really, each area has a different, many different approaches. The most important is that you mentioned also a diagnosis. Like you need a specialized person to be able to do a specific and it's a very detailed evaluation to get to a diagnosis. When we do evaluate, it depends really on the area of the problem itself. Like if it's a language problem, we do evaluate many different components that play a role in the language itself, in the expressive language. And this is where we say, yes, he has a delay. We need to work a specific number of sessions and we have to reevaluate to be able to put a diagnosis. We cannot always diagnose from the first time. What we can say, for example, he has a delay. After working for 3 months or 6 months, we will see the progress. If he's still very delayed or we're not able to fill the gap and we're doing the proper intervention, this is where we start talking about diagnosis. Also, we have to refer the child to different specialties also. We cannot always diagnose everything. Like we need sometimes the intervention of an occupational therapist, a child psychiatrist, the psychology. It really depends on the case. But the most important with the technique, like parents cannot really know and they will never know what techniques specialists are using, so they can decide if it's a good one or no. They can just, as I mentioned, know from the person himself, how he's doing, how, if the child is loving it, yes or no. If there is progress, how is he communicating what he's doing and the plan? Is he communicating the intervention plan? Because we have a plan for every child after evaluating. Is he telling the parents what his plan is? When is he expecting to reach the goals he's setting? Mm-hmm. Is he guiding them? Is he giving them advice? Telling them what they can do? They will never be therapists, by the way, parents. I never ask them to do or to repeat what I do in the session because they are parents and they should always be parents. They tend to take over, to try to be like teachers and specialists at home. They should always be parents and we give them advice as parents, not as like to repeat what we're doing in the session.
Yeah, I think that's really great to see because then you, and actually you're right, like a treatment plan, is your child like developing according to this plan? Is this person communicating with you, this therapist? Is he telling you like these are, you know, so sometimes like maybe, I mean, like Mehdi was saying, like you go through four or five or six until you find the right common person who's really you're comfortable with. They are communicating clearly. You could see some development. I mean, you can't imagine being in a session, in a speech session where the child hasn't really developed anything for the month, for example. Mm-hmm. Parents should do their homework. They should be looking up this person or the center, seeing, you know, what kind of, and definitely I think all professionals, you know, they have to have a specialty. And I think that's what you should go for. Not every speech therapist does, you know, certain.
And to mention also one point is the tests they use, the tools, the testing tools, like what tools are they using? They shouldn't know. They don't know. They cannot know. They will never know as parents. But they should also see the report after the evaluation. Is it a professional report? Is there any scoring? It depends. Like we do evaluation for kids. It depends also what age they are. But we have scoring, like we can tell exactly where they are, where is their language, the ranking, the percent, all these. They should also have the tangible things, like the reports, especially the reports, how they are, how the specialist is explaining concern they have, the problem with their child. And as I said, the results, the plan of intervention, and how is he supporting the parents and guiding them to support their child.
I mean, I think sometimes also it's the issue of, I think some parents just want to cut corners. They want to be able to go to someone who's cheaper, you know, who is going to, I know I see it here in Kuwait all the time. Like they'll go ahead and go to a therapist who might not be as experienced, who doesn't really have the right qualification, but she or he are calling themselves coaches. I mean, Mahdi and I go through this coaching thing that triggers me every time, but whatever. That was on another show. The idea is that they'll go, like for me, okay, well, I'll go to a coach, even though coaches now are costing even more, or I'll go to so-and-so, she's charging 20 KD and you're charging 50. So they want to cut corners. Mm-hmm. And I understand that we are in a global crisis right now. And I understand that parents have to really be very careful in what they spend their money. But also at the same time is that parents have to be ready to be able to help their child by being ready to afford these services. You know? So for parents that can't afford, what do they do? I mean, what do they do in Dubai? I don't know. I mean, here, I think they might be a government. I don't know, Kira, you were here.
There are government outreach programs here in Kuwait. I think for Kuwaitis and non-Kuwaitis also, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, there's definitely outreach programs here in Kuwait, especially when it comes to speech therapy, because my brother, Yagub, my younger brother, has Down syndrome and he's deaf. So when he was younger, all the tools were available for him. And then as soon as he hit a certain age, there were no specialists at that time in Kuwait to take over and continue his development. And I think at one point he was even saying words. He was, I think, moderate to profound deaf in one ear and then severely deaf in the other ear. So, you know, he had hearing aids, a whole nine yards. And it just sucked because once he hit a certain age, they were like, at the ministries, they were like, all right, you know what? He's 4 or 5 years old. That's it. Sorry. He also had trouble eating. He was eating pureed foods till he was about 4 or 5 years old. He refused to eat and chew. And part of those things was using the muscles of their mouth at the same time. The reason why I asked the question about different methods is because we used ABA. And I said this a while ago, we used ABA with DJ. And for some kids, ABA therapy works. And it's basically a behavior therapy with reinforcements. And, you know, we're going to bring an ABA specialist on the show that I already got someone. But we tried that method with DJ. It didn't work. It backfired, actually. He regressed because it was very aggressive. But with other kids, it has worked. It worked very well. But then when we went to Fozia Sultan, I forget her name, Al-Galaf. She works there. She was amazing.
Yeah, Fatma.
That's Fatma Gaban. Galaf. Oh, man, I can't remember her name. Hey, well, kill me if I say that because she loves her too. But she worked with DJ for about a year and a half to 2 years. And, you know, she did all the proper assessments. She was a graduate from Northeastern, if I'm not mistaken. So she had the Boston School of Thought, which I liked to begin with. And, you know, she used all the... I know, because I'm from there. But she used all the tests that were predominantly found at Harvard. And I liked it because I could follow it and understand it. And it was available online. And I think for some of the parents that don't have the financial resources to do that, I mean, what are some good online sites or tips online that you can send people? Which way to go? Do you have any resources that we can give people?
They just need to go to Kira's Instagram. That's the only thing they need to do. But you're right. That's what I was saying. But sometimes I was saying that there are parents that can't afford it, but they'll cut corners because they don't want to spend as much money on speech pathology because they don't think it's that important. He'll grow out of it, like we were saying earlier. So if parent doesn't really realize the seriousness of this situation with their kids, they will cut corners. They'll take them somewhere where it's cheap. Why spend 50 KD or 100? I don't know what they go with the going rate, 25, 30 for a speech therapist. And why go there when I can get them to a cheaper method? And then, you know, they'll grow out of it anyways.
Yeah. So
I think that's what I'm, you know, I feel like sometimes maybe parents are not willing to spend the money on these kind of treatment, like ABA. That's only in private sector here, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's only private sector. Yeah. Behavioral.
Kira, do you use that or no?
ABA. I'm not specialized in ABA, but there is ABA specialists and centers in Dubai. Yeah, they do. ABA, as Mahdi said, it works with some kids. It doesn't with others. And sometimes when it works in my field as a speech and language therapist, because it's a bit rigid and they repeat the same thing every time. So where we get to a point where even if language is built, like you need the pragmatics around it, like the social part of the language, where it's not, if the child, we ask him the same question, but was using different words or with different intonation, he might not be able, for example, to answer. This is where in our, I never work as an ABA, a speech and language therapist. I'm a speech and language. I work like I want the child to communicate not only in one way and through one type of communication. This is where we interfere to just build on what he learned in ABA and what he's doing to bring this pragmatic part of language.
Just to be fair, ABA is usually used with, it's used predominantly with children with autism.
Exactly. Yeah, even with high-functioning autism, like they have the language and they are communicating, they are using the language. This, ABA, as I said, is very important for behavior, for many aspects of the child development, but it doesn't replace the therapy. And there are centers who are working very well as implementing speech and language. They have a speech and language department with the ABA therapist, with other departments, where they all gather together, they all sit together to put a plan where it is everyone works, and they do common sessions like the transdisciplinary team. They do work an ABA with a speech therapist in the same session with the child to reach the goals like together and to have good outcomes.
Now, Kira, before we finish, I really want to talk about stuttering, because I know that there's something like even people I know that their kids have stuttering.
Yeah.
And also I see it sometimes in adults because of some trauma. Can you tell us what is stuttering? What are the causes of stuttering? And what can people or parents with kids who are stuttering, what should they do?
Yeah, stuttering, there's no one main cause of stuttering. Like there are studies who have shown there's also neural pathways, especially because stuttering starts when the child language is booming. So this is where usually and mainly the stuttering starts. So there's a part of neurological part in it. It's not only that, there's a genetic factor where we see stuttering running in families. And there's also and it happens sometimes around an event that happened in child's life, like a move of country, a sibling, like the birth of a sibling. Like you do have this. So it's not only one, it's many factors, let's say, that may be all present where the stuttering starts. But what we do, first when it starts, we have also, you need a specialized, and this is my field, I love stuttering. You need a specialized professional, because kids, when they start stuttering, we have, sometimes you cannot tell if it's normal, let's say, I will call it so people can understand the normal stuttering. It's like it's a part of their development because they are learning a lot of vocab and they do just repeat the word just because they need to think of the words. And it's just the normal disfluencies, we call them. And you have later the stuttering when it's really there. Kids, they do, there is tension in the body. You see a lot of repetition. It's more than one or two times the repetition. You see avoidance, like they try not to look at you. They try to avoid a word they know they will stutter on. So we do assess their speech. Like we take a speech sample and we assess it to see what type of stuttering and why. And we do it here. We support parents. Like when they first stutter, kids, we do tell them to wait. We give them advice and how to talk, how to interact with their children. And if after 3 or 6 months, we do start intervention with younger ages before 6, it's through parental coaching. It's something they do every day. It's a program parents do every day, activities, and they give feedback like praising and acknowledging the stutter-free speech. And after that, after the age of 6, we do intervene with fluency techniques. Like we teach them fluency techniques.
When can you diagnose stuttering? Is it after 6 or before 6?
No, it can be before 6. Like it depends on the onset date of the onset and how the type of stuttering, like what are, is he, how long is his stuttering? How many repetition he has? If he has tension, like he can have stuttering before the age of 6, but the type of intervention is different before the age of 6 and after the age of 5-6. We intervene and our plan is set.
So is it true that once they stutter, they'll always stutter even as adults, or can they really grow out of it or be treated out of it?
Many kids, especially before the age of 5-6, they grow out of it. If they get the right intervention and the right time, like they grow out of it. You have a percentage of children who will have stuttering for their life. But what I tell them, and when I work with kids and when I work with people who stutter, I tell them, you control your stuttering. And even if it's there and it will stay there for life, they can still have the stuttering but cannot notice it, for example. You're not a professional. You don't know about stuttering. You cannot notice that he had a stuttering moment and he was able to go out of it without you noticing, to control it, we say. Like he will have it. They will always stutter. We have people who always stutter, but they can control it using the fluency skills and technique they learn.
So you're saying it could be genetic, it could be environmental, and it could be stress.
Yeah, like it's related to neuron. If there are studies that showed in the myelination of the nerve, I don't know if I pronounce it very well. I know in French more. you have many factors, but it showed that it's related, like they are learning a lot of vocab as if they are not motor, their motor speech and their muscles, let's say, are not ready to say it so fluently. This is where they get stuck. How parents react to their stuttering is very important in helping them grow out of it or not.
Means that they should not panic and think that this is the end
of
the world.
They should not panic. They should not ask them to take a deep breath, to wait, to think before talking, take a deep breath, calm down. All these do not work.
Really? You cannot say to them, take a deep breath and relax and then say what you want to say? That's really hard.
Never help. If you ask all kids and all people who stutter, if this helps you and you can get out of your stuttering when you hear this, they all tell you no. As parents, we should be focusing on the message they are conveying and not how they are conveying the message. We should be slowing our pace. You know, we're very stressed now. We want to do everything very quickly. And these kids usually are sensitive. They react to stress in the way they talk. So we have to have a slower pace at home. This helps a lot. We have to be slower in talking, not rushing. Pausing after they talk, after they answer, after they, for example, ask or answer something, we pause and we model good speech. There are tips we give parents of kids who stutter, and it helps a lot.
So is stuttering the most common speech disorder that you see? Or are there other, because stuttering, it seems like something you hear a lot. Is there other ones that are just as common?
Yeah, language delay now is very common. Language delay because kids are staying, let's remove the COVID, but before kids are staying home with nannies, they are not being stimulated in front of screens. This is another topic that we can discuss for a long time. Like screens are really delaying a lot, speech and language development. So there are many factors. Parents are working a lot, long hours, where they are not interacting with their kids. So many factors. We are seeing a lot of kids with speech and language delay too. We have stuttering, we have learning disabilities like reading and writing.
Dyslexias also. That's true. I was thinking that a nanny, it's true. Because sometimes nanny, I was reading that, I don't know where I was reading this, is like this kid was really delayed in his language development because parents work, the nanny needed to do her job. So she would put this kid to sleep all the time. Uh-huh. So the idea is that because she was sleeping, she can't interact with him because she's got to get the job, you know, cleaning and whatever it is that she was doing. And then the parents later on realized that the kid didn't really have been developing. And they're like you said, they were busy working.
Yeah. I have parents coming like telling me, oh, my, this is her job. She needs just to work. Okay, but you can also like put a plan for her. Like myself, I used to teach the nanny. She's very good. I used to teach her how to do the work, how to do her job, and also how to play with the kids. It's a part of her job. When I have kids, I have young kids, I should be seeking help from a person who can also assist with kids. If I just need them for working, this is another, for cleaning, this is another thing. But when I have kids and I want her to take care of kids, I also should be helping her and teaching her and putting at least a plan of at least a 1 or 2 hours interaction per day with the child, of how to play, what to play with. It's very important. We cannot just keep her do whatever she wants to do and keep our child on the screens all day, or sleeping or whatever, or sitting doing nothing in front of the wall.
That's right. Because they occupy the kids by giving them electronics, or even when they're eating, they're having their iPad in front of them. So that way she could do her work or they're quiet.
Yeah.
And you're right. And I think it's harmful for parents, especially parents that not like you that are aware of this, or myself, or even Mehdi, who reads a lot. But some of these parents really don't think about that until later on, when they realize that their kid's language is delayed, or there is stuttering, or even some sort of learning disability.
You won't believe it. I see children spending 7 to 8 to 9 hours per day on screens.
Wow.
Sometimes,
especially now.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, really unbelievable. Like, you tell me, no, that's not true. It's true. And I sometimes still don't want to believe it, but I see parents with that.
But let's be realistic. I mean, not everyone can afford a nanny, or not everyone can afford someone to be with their kids all the time. And some people are privileged enough where they can afford to get their kids off of a screen, whereas some parents, they don't have any other choice but to work their job and put their kid in front of an iPad and hope that they only watch educational stuff on YouTube. So, I mean, you can't demonize parents that do that, in my opinion, because some people just don't have the means to do something else. I mean, let's be realistic, especially with COVID-19. The amount of parents that I've talked to where they're like, I can't get any work done because I'm at home. The only thing I can resort to is putting my kid on a screen. I mean, what do you say to that? They still have to keep their job, which everybody's getting fired. You know, as a parent, you still feel that self-guilt. There are times where I'm guilty of it, where DJ will be watching iPad for a little too long or whatever. But we're very blessed and lucky that we are at my in-law's house, so someone can occupy him at one time if someone needs a break. And I think that's very important right there, is mental health to a parent. And some of them, you know, that's their break time when they put their kid in front of a screen. So, I mean, I personally don't demonize people for it, because it's kind of a fact of life that I see. So, but that's just my opinion.
You're absolutely right. There are people who cannot afford me. I'm talking about people who has a nanny and whose children are being delayed. For people who do not have a nanny and who have to work, I tell them, in this period, a special period, so it's also how we are dealing with kids is special too. So if they are used to stay 2 hours and now they are staying 4 or 5, it's not a big deal. But as much as we can also teach kids at a very young age to play by themselves. Also, it's a skill. We don't have to always be present to entertain them. They should know how to entertain themselves, Mahdi. Like, they should know that now they have this half an hour where they are staying with their toys, with everything they have, to build a Lego. It depends on their age, of course. To even babies in their safe area, like, they can have toys and they can learn how to stay there while mommy is doing the dishes or cooking or working. Like, we can still teach them, and they don't have to stay 9 and 10 hours in front of TV, as much as we can. Like, as much as they can, parents, they can wash dishes, they can just play with cups, play with whatever is in the house. Even you don't need expensive material for people who cannot afford it.
No, and I think actually, Kira, you're very right, because more and more research is coming up with the imagination. Because before, parents were spending so much money trying to make sure. There was an era, what time, where we were pressured as parents to put our kids in a very certain activities, because we want to be able to increase social interaction. We want to increase their physical well-being. We want to make sure that they don't become obese because they're sitting watching TV. At least during my time, there was always this stress and push that your kids should sign them up for some activity. And, you know, it's nice in America because you could do some of that for free or cheaper. And here, parents are so busy trying to put them in activities because that's what we were told. But actually, more and more research is saying by doing that, we are inhibiting our child's creativity and imagination. So when my daughter or my son, they come to me and say, "Mom, I'm bored. What can I do?" I say, "Well, use your imagination." Why is it my job that I have to wake up every morning while I am planning my day and working and teaching and doing teletherapy? I also have to make sure that you're entertained. And so the more we push them to be creative, the more they'll be creative in, I mean, back in the days when we didn't have the screen and we didn't have any of these, like, you know, fast paced kind of parents do. I don't remember my parents that they weren't that educated. I don't remember them sitting there and telling me, "Juliet, you know, let's have these activities," or they couldn't afford to put me in a lot of activities.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I remember my brothers and sisters were creative. I remember like trying to wash dishes and doing like imitating what my mother do. And that was creative.
We didn't have iPads and all the technology but lower income families, I beg to differ. Lower income families do not have the education nor the know-how nor are given the proper tools to adapt to that scenario. Lower income families, especially single mothers, but there are studies that show single mothers in the United States with children spend 7 more hours on a device than children from a higher income family, mainly because the mom has to work, has to cook, has to clean, has to raise the kid.
But Mehdi, you're not listening. What we're saying is that she does have to work. It's not a different era. I'm saying that back in those days, they're bringing that back now. They're realizing what we've done is we've given our children a lot of screen time because we need to do our job. But what they're saying now, don't do that. Don't put them in so many activities and run from here to here to here. Even in the U.S., they do that even if they can't afford it because there are cheap places that will park districts. That's what park districts are about. You can go and sign them up for something cheaper. But that's not the point. What they're saying is we need to avoid that. What we need to do is stop having them run from an exercise class to a swimming class to a dance class because we want to keep them busy and have them sit at home while you're washing dishes. Let them be creative in whatever it is that they create. That's what they're saying. The research is saying we don't. Yes, I'm a full-time mom. Yes, I have to come home and cook and clean. And the majority of people, maybe not here, but in the US, how are their kids being entertained? They're watching the screen? Yes. Should they watch the screen? No. Why don't we just give them time to go do a puzzle? Don't tell me that has anything to do with poverty.
But that's apples and oranges. You're a professor. You're well-educated, well-rounded. You can't compare a professor to someone who doesn't even have a middle school degree. Come on.
It has nothing to do. I'm a professor and I cannot even entertain them. What I'm saying, because I am a professor, I still feel like it's not my job to entertain them. My son and my daughter, granted they're 10 and 15, they can entertain themselves. They just, because I took the electronics from this quarantine, they have remodeled their room, they have shifted furniture, and they have painted new things on the wall. It has nothing to do with me being a professor. It has something to do with parents are refusing to allow their kids to be imaginative. And there's research that says
the kids should get bored. Like, I am with a balanced, like, giving kids a balanced life, like, they don't have to spend all the days on their screens and not all the days getting bored, but they should get bored. Kids, if they don't get bored, they won't be creative. They don't use their imagination. They should get bored. They should start thinking and figuring out what to do during this time. We shouldn't, as parents should not be filling all their days, all the schedule, all the activities. They should keep a minimum of 1 to 2 to 3 hours per day where kids should figure out what to do.
And I refuse to accept that because economical, or if you're poor or rich, this has nothing to do with poor or rich. This has something to do with creativity. Actually, poor kids are probably more creative because they can't afford a lot of activities. And they can't afford a lot.
Maybe 20 years ago.
You know why? Because now most of these, even kids that can't afford a lot, they probably do have a phone and they probably do have an iPad. And that's the only thing they're doing because their parents are not taking it away and saying, look, do something with your time.
I personally know people of lower education, lower income status, that have a middle school education and their kids are glued to a phone because the parent just doesn't know any better. They weren't educated. And the tools for them, the outreach programs within our society, whether you're in the Middle East or whether you're in the West, they're just simply not there for people like that. And the kids either eventually get lost in the system, and we all know what happens there, or, you know, they stay on a screen and maybe they become, you know, a techie, which also works out. But I mean,
but I refuse to accept that the education of the parents has Legos.
Not everybody has these things. Come on, you don't have to have a Lego.
If you look up
so
research,
then why are more lower income families in the United States spending more screen time on TV?
Plastic cups, plastic dishes. I'm sorry. Most everyone can afford a puzzle. Most everyone has a paper and a pencil, and they can cut. Don't tell me that money or education has anything to do with it. Granted, we're at an advantage because we're all educated. But what I'm saying is that back in the days, it's not different from now. Back in the days, most parents were illiterate and the kids were allowed to have a scissor and a piece of paper and plastic cup to create something. Don't tell me that cost money. What is better for these parents are exhausted, they're tired. And the easiest thing is to give them a pad. It has nothing to do with education. I'm sorry. Right? Nowadays, you can Google how to entertain my child, how to enhance imagination. That is what you do.
Some of these people at a lower education don't know that. You can't say that. Some people at a lower education don't have that information. They don't even know how to Google.
Oh my God.
I know people personally that are at a lower education that don't know even understand Google.
Please help me.
Can I say one word? One thought. I don't know if you have experienced this, but what I know from the stories of my parents, of their grandparents, and of their parents.
But that's a different time. You know, I don't think we can compare.
No, honestly, we can't compare.
That's apples and oranges. Come on.
Mahdi, let me finish. They were not educated, but when you want to do something and when you feel there's something wrong, I'm talking about another point. Please don't interrupt me. When parents feel there's something wrong, they will go seek help. They will ask the neighbor, the doctor, other parents who are in the same situation. They will go search for a solution when they feel. You're right, they are not educated. They are not maybe, they do not have access to education. But parents have this inside feelings, the intuition, like this is something wrong. My child shouldn't be sitting all day on his PS4. What can I do? When they start questioning and saying, what can I do? This is where they go and seek help somewhere else.
You're right, Kira. And also, I refuse to accept that most of these parents nowadays have social media. Do you know how many people go on social media and explain? There are people like Kira who does it for free. You only have to have an Instagram account. And please don't tell me they don't have Instagram account where they can look up. They see information. Back in the days, you're right, we didn't have anyone on social media where I taught my mom how she should raise 6 kids. But nowadays, even the ones that are poor and uneducated, they have Instagram, they have all these social media platforms, and there's so many professionals out there teaching us about imaginations, creativity that requires no money. I know myself, I have gone on so many platforms talking about that and how we should allow them to be bored. And we don't need to run around trying to exhaust ourselves as parents because I want to put them in skating, gymnastic, and whatever the hell it is.
It's because you can afford it. That's because you can afford it. Some of these people can't. That's my point.
You're missing the point. The point, they should not do that. That's what I'm saying. I can afford it, but I'm not doing it anymore. From now on, they have one activity when we go back to normal. You're missing the point. I'm not saying because I can afford it, I should give them. The point is, even if you can afford it, don't give them activities like that. You're missing the point. I refuse.
I'm not even talking about
Even if
about
I can
that,
afford
though.
It, I will not put them in. No, that's what I'm telling you, that parents are not supposed to sign up on activities. They are supposed to allow their kids to be creative on their own in the house. Even when they're bored, they should be able to work with their boredom to create something. That's what we're talking about. That's what Kira and I are talking about. We're not talking about money.
I was talking
education.
About screen time. That was it. I was just talking about the whole screen time and generalizing that, you know, people shouldn't do this when in reality, some people don't and can't afford the time nor have the means to understand not to put their kid in front of a screen. And I think there are thousands of studies out there proving that lower income people do not have the educational means to know better whether to put their kid in front of a screen or not.
Yeah, I understand that. But I'm saying that nowadays we have a lot more education through our social platform that says you shouldn't have. I mean, the majority of the people, we're not talking about the minority, the majority of the people, they know 8 hours is a lot of hours to put our kid in there. So I understand that you're saying that they don't have the minimal knowledge to understand 8 hours is too long. I'm saying that we do have a lot of educational platforms nowadays that are simple, that are educating our, I mean, we're doing a podcast on it. I know that not everyone can be listening to these podcasts, but I'm saying they have a means. And just like Kira was saying, back in the days, they didn't even have social media, but they asked their parent, other parents, what do your kids do when they're bored? We get ideas. And the same thing, these parents, having education or money or status has nothing to do with allowing my kid to be creative in the house with whatever it is that I can afford. They don't have to be on their iPod. But as you said earlier, parents are exhausted, they're tired, and it's the easiest thing to do. It is. It's true. But should we allow parents to just like sit, it's the easiest, so let me do it? No, I don't agree with it. What do you think, Kira?
Yeah, absolutely. It's like if the screens were there when my grandma was born, they would be in the same, maybe discussing the same issue that we're discussing right now. Screens came, if they were not there, we would not be discussing. They are there. We should just maybe work on raising awareness and trying to reach more as much as we can. People, it's also at the governmental maybe level, not only us, but I think if everyone, every person who is able to educate others, if everyone does a little bit of help, of support, of giving back to the community, I think we can reach all these old people who cannot really have access to the information. We have to start, each one has to start with himself.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. It's more education, educating people, and I think schools do it all the time. I think schools, every kid does go to school, regardless of where you live and how much money you make. And I think in the schools, they do try to push time on.
And there is a point. There is a point also, you mentioned, like, people have access to social media. And from what we see, like, I will talk about my experience in Kuwait and in Dubai. Mothers are spending a lot of time on screens, but checking wrong, like, okay, there are things that
fashionistas and bloggers.
We need this escapade. Like, we need to not always think of what should I do, and also about education, like educating myself. We need this time, but we also, there are people spending a lot of time on wrong platforms where they can at least if they want more, they can get more. It's the need. They should. It's within. This is what I believe. It's within. It's the mother has this intuition, the father also. There is something wrong, and they go seek help. We said at the beginning, when there is something wrong, they shouldn't be just listening to one professional. And when they feel there's something wrong, they will go and search and go consult with many professionals until they get to answer that really heals their concern. And this is what happens also in everything in our life. In all aspects, this is what I believe. When I feel something in within, I will go search for the answer.
And nowadays, platform, I mean, I'm sure you get that and I get that. So many people ask me for advice and it's for free on my Instagram. I answer it until it starts to get complicated. But, you know, if you are wondering, should I put my kid for 8 hours? My kid is doing nothing but watching TV. It's more about the comfort of the parents. The parents do not want to be able to research, is this okay or not? Like I said, most parents can at least Google, or they can go to a platform. They see someone that is professional, ask them, you know, message them. Is it okay? Do you think this is all right? If they could ask me, it's for free. They don't have to pay for that. I can answer, no, I don't agree. Yes, I agree. Yeah, there are channels out there. I mean, I'm on Kuwait TV every day talking about different things. And one of them was imagination. There are so many free platforms where they can learn. But as Kira was saying, most of the parents want an escape. So they are on platforms for the wrong thing. They'll follow a fashionista and they'll follow a blogger. They'll follow all these people and they have all the information they need on fashion and makeup and I don't know what, real life and reality shows, movies, Netflix, but they're not bothering themselves to ask a simple question. The simple question should be Googling, how many hours is it okay to have my kid watch TV or be on screen? It's simple. It has nothing to do with education. I mean, my mom is illiterate and she could tell you. Seriously, she doesn't have a lot of education. You can ask her now.
I think you guys mix with different social circles because I can tell you that I work and I know a lot of people that think it's okay and they don't know the difference. But no, that
they're
Dr.
not educating.
D, no, but that's a different social circle. You've never mixed with that social circle. That's the thing. Not everyone has the same ideologies that we have, that we are discussing. There are different social circles out there that don't understand that. And to think that they don't exist, I mean, come on, they do. They definitely do. I know it for a fact.
No one said they don't exist.
But they do. It's a large majority. And it's probably a bigger part of our society than you imagine.
Mehdi, I didn't say they don't exist. I said they are not spending the right time. Because those people that you're talking about, believe me, I see a lot of them at the clinic also, and I've heard about them. So I'm not blind. I've lived in this country long enough. And actually, this is not just this country, it's everywhere. What I am saying, those individuals still have access to social media and still have access to phones. Simple. And they're choosing not to look at those platforms. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying they don't exist. I'm saying they don't want to implement and change some of their routines and value. I know so many parents, they just don't want to be bothered. Granted, they're depressed. They have a lot of work. They're stressed about finances. I understand that. But don't tell me that they have social media. Tell me how many people you know don't even have social media access.
Who, me? All my friends, everyone I know. But
no, these people that you're talking about,
they don't
do they have
know
social
any better,
media
Dr.
access?
D, if they don't know any better.
Maybe here it's the role of the pediatricians are the main specialist, whoever has an issue, like all kids are followed up by pediatricians. And this is where really good pediatricians are raising awareness on many aspects. They are checking not only the medical part of the child, also the developmental part, and they are guiding parents. And this is, in this discussion, we cannot solve this problem. It's, as I said, it's on a higher level, but this is, I think, it's the basic that they should get from the main specialist who follows up kids who are typically developing, who do not seek neither psychological support nor speech and language therapy, nor none. They have never been to therapy or to therapist or to specialist. At least the pediatrician should have here a big role in guiding them and raising awareness.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, that's
actually
a very good point. Yeah, no, that's a really good point.
Because everyone does see a doctor, a pediatrician or someone.
I think you just settled mine and Dr. D's argument. Sorry, we do this every once in a while. We have a heated debate.
Kira, don't get concerned.
Yeah.
It's just the way we do it.
look,
all your podcasts are the same.
Yeah, they're all like that. most of them. He always says something to trigger me, and then I go off.
look, I have to play devil's advocate. Someone has to play the other role. Honestly, look, all I'm saying is the generalization of it with some people. That's it. Because I know people of lower income.
You're right, absolutely.
And lower education. They have no clue. I swear to you, I knew a guy who's coming, will the Diamond Al-Jihaz. And, you know, this guy's like 45 years old. I can't say, well, shuf emmi, and you know, like screen time's bad and blue light and everything. Where's he going to understand all? But in Dubai, what you guys get over there, which I think Kuwait and other GCC countries should implement, is when I was there, I think a year ago, they had this huge campaign of taking care of their elderly. It was everywhere, all over the malls, everywhere. And it was like, take care of your elders, spend time with your elders, your grandparents, so forth. Those are the things that are impactful. Those are the things that I think if it's drilled into the society enough, they understand the awareness, a marketing campaign from the government, raising awareness on your children's screen time and its effects, then people will start to take notice more. Versus it's just one of those things that I see. And in Dubai, they do a great job, you know, and I mean, they do an excellent job of raising awareness there.
Yeah. And I still believe when it comes to children, pediatrician, they have the biggest role. But unfortunately, they are not all all taking care of the developmental aspect. Yeah. Like they are just checking up ears and throat and nose and that's it. But you have also plenty of pediatricians who are really asking these detailed questions, like, is your baby holding a toy in his hand? Is your baby starting to crawl? Yeah, I always search for a pediatrician who does this before checking the stomach and the eyes and the nose.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Yes, yes. Well, thank you so much, Kira. I know I took you away from even putting your baby to sleep.
Okay.
She's fine. Oh my God.
Daddy more.
It's good. We gave Danny something to do today. He put him to sleep. I'm sorry we took you away from her.
Thank you so much. This was a lot of fun. And next time I'm in Dubai, I'll definitely get in touch with you. We'll have a live podcast without Dr. D.
It won't be fun without me.
That's so true. That is so true.
Thank you, Kira.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tell hi to Danny and everyone. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. You can also find us on Instagram @ The Project Kuwait. Thank you, and join us next time.